All right, so grab a handout, and we'll get to work for today. We're in the transform arm of Roots, and thus far we've spent the last couple months going through the two first sections of Roots, which is pursue and embrace. Both of those, pursue being the way. Hey, what's up, little kid outside? So pursue being the first way for us to kind of understand what we're to believe, understand what we're supposed to know, and then embrace is our way of saying, okay, now how do we start to fold that into our lives and get that to be a part of who we are. Transform is the way that we're going to say, okay, now that you've got it and now that you love it and now that you know it, then we're going to be able to take that out into the planet and be able to show where. All right, so everybody wave. Just turn around and give a little wave. There you go. Now the mom's embarrassed. That's okay. Wait for him to pass the window. He'll probably look again. Oh, the umbrella. It's not really helping in the rain. Okay, so the first question we've got in the transform arm is, how should I look at the world? Now, if you were here Wednesday, it's really kind of awesome the way God worked all of that out, because everything about Wednesday was framing our view of the world, framing our way that we look at how life is going on, and then now we've got some even better ways to do that. So how should I look at the world? We've got a bottom line, which is at the bottom of your handout. You get nothing else from the talk today. We want you to get this, and it's see correct. See correct. Correct yourself. See correct. Now, for those of you who've had points in your life where your vision has been jacked, you've gone to an eye doctor. They've had you look at a screen with a bunch of letters, and then they've said, identify what's on line 4. And then you start to read it. Some of you have probably guessed through because you don't want to wear glasses or contacts. So you've been like, it looks kind of like an N, and hoping you got there. When you take a driving test, you're going to have to put your face in a what looks like, remember when we were little kids, little red pair of glasses that you put the little thing in, and you went, I don't even know what that's called. A viewfinder? Well done, Latashe. Well done. Okay, so you had like the little red viewfinder, and you'd get those little spiral pictures, and you put it in, and when you go to the driver's license office, you're going to have to put your face in something like that. Press your forehead against this little plastic plunger thingy, and then it's going to pull up different signs that you're going to have to identify. Merge, yield, caution, you know, all of those good things. And then they're going to have to make sure, can you see? Because there's nothing worse than somebody driving who can't see. Like, that's probably the worst thing on the planet, because your vehicle has just become a weapon. So now what we want to do in terms of the world is we want to say, you need to see the way the planet is, and you need to see the planet correctly if you're going to live how Jesus has taught us in the last couple months, and you're going to put that into the planet. You need to see correctly in order to do so. And so, again, we're going to hit this question, how should I look at the world? And the first way we want to kind of lay the bedrock for this is called the Genesis Foundation, which sounds like the coolest nonprofit organization ever created. The Genesis Foundation. The Genesis Foundation. The Genesis Foundation. I'm going to start that here in a little bit. All right, so what this is where the book of Genesis lays the foundation for the entire planet. And so it starts, God creates all things, makes all things, forms all things. Then we see life gets pretty jacked up. And then God shows how the story of Genesis translates from two people in a garden to an entire nation about to go into Egypt. And so Genesis lays the bedrock for that. We're just going to give you a couple statements to help let this resonate. First, creation becomes personal when God says, let us make man in our image. And so it's not just God saying, let's create some two-legged, two-armed people and just put them down there. It should kind of look alien, but we don't even know if aliens exist yet. So let's make them shorter. Let's give them 4 heads, maybe 5 heads for some of you. And so they start to say, okay, let's make man. If you didn't get the joke, soon you'll catch it. If there's man in our image. And so God just doesn't create impersonally, because dogs, cats, and other things don't look like God does. Only man has the characteristic of man being in God's image. And so creation is really personal, because it's God's way of saying, I'm going to take me and I'm going to put it on this thing that I've made. And humanity's purpose is to be the image of God on the planet. And so as we see that humanity had a place, it was called the garden. We see that in Genesis 2:15. And that this was a place where man dwelt with God and had relationship with him. It says that man would walk daily with God through the garden, that they would speak with him, they'd celebrate with him. There was purpose and alignment, because God said, these are the things that you're to do. Here's what's supposed to happen. And so everything is perfect at this point. man's there. He's got a wifey. The whole point is have babies, take care of the planet, live the good life, and you're naked and nobody knows, right? That's a good time. And if you were around a little while ago, we had this thing called no shame nakedness. It's the best part about marriage. So garden exists, and there's all of this good times going on. Now, if you know, if you've been a part of Christianity, you know how the story goes. Genesis 3 comes around. And so it didn't take humanity long to botch the entire thing. So there's the devil comes in form of a serpent, which is a snake, slithers over, starts talking to the wife, says, hey, you know, what about this tree you're not supposed to eat from? She says, oh yeah, we eat that, we're going to die. And he says, are you really going to die? She says, for sure, we're going to die. He's like, you're not going to die if you eat the fruit. It's just a fruit. Have a bite of the fruit. Doesn't it look delicious? She bites from the fruit. She goes, woo, this fruit is tasty. She gives some to her husband, which is what all wives do when they have tasty meals. Here's, try some of this. He bites from it. And then now all of a sudden, what once was no shame nakedness was, oh my God, we're butt nakedness. And so then they try to run and hide themselves, hide into the bushes, start covering themselves up. God comes walking around and says, hey, where you guys at? As if God needed information about their location. He didn't. And so as he's walking, he finds them and says, what are you guys doing? Adam, who he addresses first, Adam's like, man, it was this woman you gave me. It wasn't me. It was that woman, which is always what happens in arguments between husbands and wives. It's woman and man, and then it goes crazy, all right? So then the woman says, man, it wasn't me. It was the snake. It was that crazy talking snake. Yeah, because that wasn't crazy ever, right? I don't know. We don't know if every animal talked at that point. We don't know if everybody was playing Aslan like it was Chronic What Calls of Narnia, but the snake is talking and is having conversation. So then he said, no, it's a snake. So God then in succession says, all right, snake, here's what you got. Woman, here's what you got. Not like woman, like that, just to make sure. But female, here's what you have. And male, here's what you have. So we're going to just kind of hit the high points. First, in condition, what happened to our condition? Humanity lost relationship and a privileged position with God, which was be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth, subdue it, rule over it. And so there was we have this standing, and because of sin, a lot of that was lost. Now, God's promise in that, and it begins Genesis 3:15. God proclaims the gospel in Genesis 3:15. There's coming a son who's going to crush you, talking snake. And so here's what the promise is. God in Christ is willing to pay whatever price to restore and renew the connection between God and humanity. So as sin severs that connection, God says, man, whatever the price is, and ultimately it's Christ on the cross, that this is what's going to happen in order to restore that. Then we've got Satan's promise, which is kind of a weird play on God has a promise, and then Satan has a way that he's going to work this out, that ultimately Satan's goal towards you is to separate you, first from God, then from the church, then from your family, and ultimately to isolate you. And so if Satan can get you away from here, he's beginning to have a little bit of a victory. And so one of the things for us that I've said with our interns and our leaders is we want to create an environment here that if you leave, it's because you're choosing to leave, not because we have to apologize about something. And there's been a lot of times in the past where we've had to apologize about some stuff. So for some of you, you've come and you felt like, man, nobody talks to me. We're trying to address that really heavy. So by the time you walk in the door, you've been hit by a bunch of people that are saying, what's up? We've also tried to find ways to connect you to people and to say, okay, coming to a room and sitting there is probably the most boring thing you could do in your whole life. And so we want to try to make that it feels more like family when you get here. But if you get separated, you know, if it starts to just transition, no, I don't want to wake up that bad. No, I don't feel like going. I'll go every once in a while. If I'm awake and I'm feeling good, which does that ever happen at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday? So if I'm up and I'm feeling good and I'm feeling feisty and I want to go and I got clean clothes and I'll look fresh, then yeah, I'll go. So as that separation starts to happen, if Satan can get you out of here, then what ultimately starts to happen is there's what's called self-hatred. And it's not you just looking in the mirror going, I hate myself, like it's an emo song. It's not that. But it's your way of starting to, when you start to realize who you are, and when you start to realize some of the things that are in you, and everybody does, like puberty is probably the worst period in life, because you look in the mirror and go, dang it, another one? And you have to like pop out a pimple. And then, you know, as a boy, you've kind of got some throat issues that cause you to lose your manliness. And even like for me, man, I've been out of puberty for a decade, and I still got some times. And so those moments where you're like, oh, and then I even had like some pimples this morning. I was like, what happened? Maybe my testosterone levels are through the roof. Who knows? But then there starts to be this part where as you look at you and you can't fix you and you can't resolve you and you start to see the same old things you've been getting into or the same old things you're doing, then you start to realize, man, I can't fix me. I can't. Every part of me is broken. And what that'll do is it just isolates you from people. It'll keep you away from people. You'll start to have really shallow connections because you don't want people to know the depth of you, because if they really figure out who they are, who you are, not only are you going to hate you, but they're going to hate you too. And so some of you just keep really shallow, surfacey relationships because you've got some things in you that you don't want to come out. You don't want people to know. And even the fact that you think God doesn't know is indicative of the fact that you're just trying to bury things as deep as possible, and that's ultimately going to isolate you. And if you're isolated, then you become desolated, which desolated is your way of when you're apart. If you're on a deserted island, what starts to happen is you don't have food, you don't have water, you weren't able to bring those three people to a desert island that the game says. You're just by yourself on an island. There is no Jack, there is no Sawyer, there is no Kate, no Saeed, there's no crazy numbers, no smoke machine coming around. Ain't none of that. It's just you on an island with the little palm tree that's got no coconuts. What happens then is you just start to get desolated, man. You just start to die off. And so as you wither, that's just you lose strength. And some of you have been mowing a yard for long enough that you could feel some of the beginning points of desolation. When it's like even hard to push, you start to see mirages in your own backyard that you know don't exist, but you're imagining things on the fence. And so that starts happening. So when you're at that point, the easiest place for you is to be devoured, right? So what happens in cartoons or in movies? Someone's close to death and the birds start circling. Why? Because they're ready to devour, right? Because there'll come a point where even though you're alive, you can't fight a bird anymore. And you're going to have your eyeballs plucked out, because apparently that's the most delicious to a bird. Awful, right? So that's indicative of what happens. And that's just the stages it goes through, that as sin takes its root, man, ultimately that's where it's going to press itself out. Now, God just doesn't leave it like that, says, I'm going to solve the problem. And here's God's plan and his delivery. Revelation 13:8 says that Jesus was crucified from the foundation of the world. So as the world is built, Jesus is crucified and ready to go. Now, some of you are going to start having questions. Like, that should bring up a couple. Oh, wait a second. Now, if God knew that, we have a series coming up in the summer called Just Ask. We'd ask you to submit a question. We'd love to answer it. Okay, so God demonstrated his willingness to pay whatever price in order to restore the relationship between God and humanity, as well as humanity's original purpose and authority. So as we've talked about Christ and his death, it's not just you coming forward at an altar and saying, I'm really sorry, Jesus, I'll make it to heaven someday. That what God does in it is its restoration and restoring you to your original purpose, like why God put you on the planet in the first place before you jacked yourself up, and then restoring you to that purpose and giving you authority to walk it out. We've put some scriptures down there at the bottom. They're also at the bottom of your handout. Check it. Now, our story plays Ephesians 2. Man, we've shared this and we beat this to a pulp for about 40 weeks. So Ephesians 2, the portion of it that's really important, says you were dead in your transgressions and sins, but now God has made you, and it continues on. And the 4 points we want to hit for today is that we are made alive in Christ, we're raised up with Christ, we're seated with Christ, and that we are created in Christ for good works. So as sin creates in us death, God says, by Christ's death, you're made alive. And that as sin causes us to just fall into desolation and being devoured, Christ's death raises us up in new life. So when we were on the point of being devoured by the devil, Christ comes, dies on the cross, and raises us up. And then it says that he just doesn't leave us on the desert island, hoping that we'll make it again. No, instead, he plucks us from there and seats us with him so that we're where he is. And that as he does so, that every one of us is created in Christ for good works. So not to aimlessly wander the world as a dummy, but saying, man, Christ has created you for special purpose and special reason in order to walk this out. And so every one of us is rooted in the planet when we understand that our role is to be able to share that story with others who need to hear it. So it'd be like if there were 1,500 desert islands and every person was on the desert island being devoured, and it was just a series of tropical desert islands that only had one palm tree and no coconuts, and everybody was dying at the same pace. If you were all of a sudden made alive, made fresh, not devoured, and you had a plane and you were able to fly, wouldn't you be the chump if you leaned over and were like, suck us? And then, okay, you're a jerk. right? Now, if we take that to the same place, right? Because some of you know how to share this story better than I do. And for us, a lot of the ways that we could interact with the planet could be the very same way. That we're flying over desert islands just looking at people who need something, and instead of giving help, just waving. Are you having fun? I hope you're having fun, because you're going to die soon. If that was the way that we played this out, then that is probably the most selfish, arrogant, and one of the most butthole moves of all time. I didn't really know what else to come up with except butthole. It's a butthole move. And so for us, you're on the planet, and Christ has revealed himself to you in the planet to put what you are, where you are, when you are, with who you are on the planet, so that what Christ has done in you, you could share with the world. And we're going to tell you how to share it. The next blank is this, is that transformation is a process. Transformation is a process. Transformation is a process. Now, I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this sentence that Evan's going to put on the screen, because I think you need to track with some of this, that we've been transformed, that we're being transformed, and we will be transformed. Now, that is past, present, and future, all in one sentence. It's the greatest sentence ever formed. We have been transformed, we are being transformed, and we will be transformed. So what does that mean? For if you know Jesus right now, there should be some transformation of your soul. It shouldn't just be, man, I've adopted a cool set of, you know, lifestyle principles. But you in Jesus should be able to say, man, I can point out some transformation, this, this, this. It also means that you're being transformed, as in you're not done yet. That every one of us has got some junk that still needs to be worked out. And so when we first get Christ, all of the overt stuff is what we deal with first. But then a lot of us keep some subtle. We keep some of the little things inside that maybe other people don't know or don't hear about, but are still in there. And so when Christ comes on the planet, one of the ways he deals with religious people a lot is, okay, you've got this and you're talking about all of this outright. But man, you got some junk inside of you that's just as bad as the outright. And if you, given the right opportunity and given the right availability, you would do everything your heart desires if you know you wouldn't get caught. And so there's a heart issue that's being talked about. And then we will be transformed, ultimately saying perfection will not be attained by us on the planet, but God's going to work it out. And that when every one of us dies, then man, we enter into glory as the perfect version of ourselves. And so ultimate transformation happens in eternal life. But when you meet Christ, there should be transformation. And as you know Jesus, he should continue to work stuff out of you. Like, it shouldn't be a digression to worse as you've spent more time with Jesus. So if you've been in the game for 15 years, hopefully you're better off now than you ever have been. Right? Like, you weren't selling crack as a four-year-old. You know, you weren't doing some, you know, you weren't running anything at eight. And so as you start to see, man, if your heart is starting to shift away, then you've got to start asking yourselves the question of why, if all of these things have been true and I've been trained up, how am I falling off when I should continue to be getting better? And so we've been, we will, and we are. All right, now, 2 Corinthians 3:16 to 18 says that we're transformed from one degree of glory to another. And for me, it plays that, man, the more time I spend around Jesus, as I look in the past, I go, man, I can't believe I was there. Or I can't believe I was here. I can't believe I was here. I can't believe I was here. And then just even seeing the progress in the last 13 years for me, man, when Jesus first got a hold of my life, I was like, dang, I'm set. And then as he continued to get a hold of it, man, there's stuff now that in 10 years, I'm going to go, can you believe I was doing that? Like, can you believe I thought that way or knew that way? And one of the things you find about learning is when you first learn something, you're convinced you're the smartest person ever made. Like, you could solve all the world's problems because you know that thing. Gosh. But the more you study, the more you give yourself to it, the more you find out you don't know jack. Right? So you could, like, you could ace a physics test, and you're like, oh, man, I got force and vectors and all that good. I just killed that. But the more you study physics, there's going to come a point where you're going to have a mental explosion and go, I could spend my life studying this thing and never get to the end. Right? Like, even the greatest astrophysicist, there's still a lot of stuff they don't know. And they're still studying and they're still learning. And so for every one of us, there's this progression of, you get to the point where you go, I don't know how I could learn any more than that. And then you learn more than that. Like, I don't get how this could be any better. And then it gets better. And that's why Jesus would use a marriage metaphor. Because when you first get married, it's crazy. It's awesome. Like, you've never lived in a house with somebody of the opposite sex before, never shared finances, never been able to buy stuff together and get stuff together and buy houses and build houses, and you never got to just walk around naked whenever you wanted to because you had the same gender roommates, and that would have been really awkward if you would have done that. But now you can do whatever you want, man. You have babies. It's great. Get a yard, buy some front porch patio, drink tea at night. It's good, right? And so the initial part, they call it the honeymoon stage, right? Because it's so good. You're off in like Cabo, and then you're just out hanging out in an all-inclusive resort. You eat food whenever you want to. You call room service whenever you want to. You don't have to leave your room, but you choose to. So you go out on the beach, and you lay on the beach, and people deliver you drinks whenever you want. And you just lay around and have a great time. Okay, that period's going to end, and then real life's going to start, right? And so there is no Cabo St. Lucas in the Chandler house, right? There's not a button that I say, Rachel, cola, right? Or we haven't hired some servants just to whenever, bing, and then they come, hey, what can I get for you, Mr. Chandler? That's not the way it goes. Real life is going to start, but that doesn't mean that right now is worse than the honeymoon stage. Like, if you were to ask Rachel or I, hopefully she would agree. We'll see, test her afterwards. But right now, it's better being married right now than it was when we started. And a lot of that, not because we could just go out and have, you know, Mexican steak whenever we wanted to, but because the depth of our relationship, that even when times come that are real life, that there's depth there, that we're not just going to have it be all, you know? Like, no one's going home angry because we're both home. And then as that progresses, man, soon we're going to be 60, 70, 80, 90. We're going to be a bunch of old, senile, old people who just sit on the porch, and I want to be angry sometimes and, like, yell at neighborhood kids and, like, throw sticks, but also give really good candy and then try to pretend like I'm hip on technology and not really. When the holograms are coming up in front of my porch, all the good stuff that's going to be here in like 60 years, right? That's going to be there. But when we get to that point, like, how awesome is marriage going to be then? Because we probably won't even have to talk. We'll telepathically communicate. Like, I'll just be able to look at her. Mold bride. And then just whoopsh. So that's one glory to the next glory to the next glory. And you would hope, like, her parents and my parents are like in the empty nest stage, which is supposed to be one of the greatest seasons of your life. Why? Because your kids are gone and you have way more money than you've ever had before. So you can live like a knucklehead if you, you know, discipline yourself forward. Get a retirement account, pay into that account, sacrifice temporary pleasures so you could have like lifelong joys, get a really good retirement so you retire at 60, get somebody who's cool with that and teach you. It's good stuff. So when that time comes, right, we're going to retire on a good amount of money. And so what are we going to do? I don't know. Buy a motorhome, drive the country. I don't know. Maybe we'll put a pool in our house and just swim around all day and make Arnold Palmers and just lay in the little, you know, pool chairs. I don't know what we're going to do, but it's going to be like the greatest season when we kick all of our kids out and just say, man, we're young, but we're still kind of old, but we're young enough to still be able to walk around and have some fun. Let's just go have a blast, right? Like, that's going to be one of the best seasons of our life. And then we're going to get older and we're going to have like a super cool old house, maybe by the beach somewhere that's got cool beach stuff on the inside. I'm spending way too much time here. But this is the way that it goes from one glory to the next glory to the next glory, because, you know, early 20s marriage is awesome. But, man, the 30s are going to be legit when we've got, like, our young, you know, hockey team that's going to be running around our house. You know, when Jude's got, you know, a younger sister, a couple younger brothers. That's the way I'd like to see it. And so as that plays, man, we'll have, like, our little tribe, our little Chandler clan. And how much fun is that going to be? T-ball practice, hockey practice, football practice, going to the ballet if that's what my little girl's into, whatever, man. Playing Barbies, sipping on some tea at her little Barbie table. That's going to be the best. And then they'll be teenagers, right? And everybody goes, oh, God, they're going to be teenagers. No, that's not the way I view it, man. How much fun is it going to be when I got a kid who I get to teach how to drive, teach how to grill, teach how to mow the yard so I don't have to anymore? You know, these are going to be some great joys for me. And that's going to be awesome. And then what happens when every one of them starts to graduate and we cry every time we say, I just remember when you were a baby, just a little bit. And then we get to show when their friends come over to our house to have like a little party and to celebrate them and to give them good gift cards. We're going to make sure the first page is open to their butt naked baby pictures. And it's going to be great, right? And then we're going to kick them all out. And then that's going to be great. And then we're going to get really old. And then we're going to start to have grandbabies. Isn't that going to be great? Because then we don't have to play by parents' rules anymore. We can just buy all kinds of stuff with all kinds of money we got and just give them all kinds of ice cream and candy and deliciousness and not have rules, but to say, I'm still your parent, so I'm going to do this thing. Even though your parents and them, if they come to my house, they're going to play by my rules. That's going to be awesome, right? And then what's the next thing after that, man? We go to heaven. And so it's one degree of glory, and that's the same thing in your relationship with Jesus. That it should, you should be continuing to celebrate where you are with Jesus, because it just keeps getting better. And the more time you spend around Jesus, the better it gets. In the same way, the more time I spend with Rachel, the better it gets. Bill Johnson is an author, and he says this, that a reformation has begun, and at the heart of the great move of the Spirit is the total transformation of the people of God as they discover their true identity and purpose. Great purpose elicits great sacrifice. If you know why you're alive, then you're going to do whatever you can to pursue that. And so our purpose, 2 Corinthians 4, 6-10, is to show that the all-surpassing power of God, it's not from us, that it's a God thing why we are where we are. And if you love Jesus, then everything you put your hands to should be better than those who don't know Jesus. So if you're a follower of Jesus, you should be the best employee because you love Jesus and you've got purpose. If you're a doctor, then be the best doctor because you know Jesus and you've got purpose. If you're going to be a mechanic, if you're going to be whatever, there are no greater jobs when it comes to Jesus, and there is no greatest purpose. The greatest purpose in your life is the one Jesus made you for. So if your purpose is to be a mechanic and you decide it's better to be a pastor, you've missed out, and you won't love this as much because you should have been something else. And so the greatest purpose in your life is why Christ made you. And if he made you to do something that you're like, I don't know why he would do this, you're ultimately not going to be fulfilled unless you're getting your hands on why Christ made you alive. And when you get your hands on that, then there is no greater joy and you excel beyond everyone else because the one who made you is the one who's carrying you through. So what does a transformed life look like? We just got a couple blanks. Let's go to John 17 really fast. John 17, page 773. I'm going to have you open it. I'm going to summarize it, and then you'll look at it later. All right, so John 17, it's on page 773. So grab the Bible on the table, open up to page 773. You'll probably use this later, I would bet. All right, so John 17, page 773. John 17, page 773. This is what's known as the high priestly prayer. It's a time when Jesus is in the garden. He's getting ready to be delivered over to death. And as Jesus is praying, he starts to ask, and him and God just start to make statements about certain things. And so what we're going to do is we're going to put up a summary, and you could just look at these and just know where they are. And then when you go home later on, read this whole thing. It's super good. And so the first thing is he says, the first part of that, that the Father, your Son has come to glorify you. And so if we've come to know Jesus, that ultimately we're living for the glory of God. That verse 3 says that we're to know Jesus and the Father. So we're to have this intimate connection with Jesus. That we're to know the Word, verse 8. So this thing you're holding in your hand has existed for thousands of years and yet still continues to speak in the present world. So you should know this. I mean, you should thrive on, you should spend your days before this to be able to open up the Scriptures and say, what is God saying? And to know the Word. Because there is no greater confidence than when things start to go awry, that if you know the Word, man, you could start to call things out that God has placed in there. So to know the Word, verse 15, that the Lord protects us while we're in the world, according to his name, verses 11 and 15 say that. And so Jesus praying, like, hey, I'm not in the world, I'm not going to be present in the world, but man, protect my people in the world. That we're sent as Jesus was, verse 18, Christ came in the world to reveal the Father, and that all people would be saved through him. And we're sent as Jesus is, to reveal Jesus, to show who Jesus is, and that people could come to trust and believe in Jesus. And that verses 22 to 26 say that we're one with Jesus and the Father. So it's not that we're just distant orphans, but that God is absorbing us into himself. And so when we are in God, that we're perfected through unity in this house, like we are a unified collaboration, we are together in this, that we operate in love as the primary way that we deal with one another, that we deal with each other in love, and that we're obedient to Christ, if even unto death. And ultimately, that's the worst case scenario, you dying. Anything else is not the worst case scenario. And the worst case scenario really isn't that bad, because if we die, we go to be with Jesus. And that seems to me to be the sweetest deal going. And so the worst thing that could happen in your life is you die. And if you die, you go to be with Jesus. And so we're obedient to him knowing, man, even if I die, that's awesome. because I'm going with Jesus. And that everything that comes our way, that we operate with the same mind of Christ, saying, hey, I'm going to be obedient to this thing until the days of my life end. I'm obedient and I'm with him. Even into the very end, Jesus, you're mine. And so there's some key components to when we're transformed and we operate like that, that are key components of the transformed life. And that's unity, we're together, and humility, we're humble. So we are together in this thing. Like, no one is better here than the other. I know I've got a microphone and I've got to talk about leading this crew, but I'm not better than you are. Like, there's not more awesomeness stored up for me because of my role. It's just my role here. And Tanner and Jesse and Gabe, and they're not better than you are just because they get a microphone or they get an instrument. But all of us together is what makes us more awesome. And so some of you got to start letting your gifts fly and stop thinking because you don't play music that you don't have a place here. Like, some of you just got to start letting some things roll. You know, and there might be times where I'd like, if you play a fife, I don't know how that's going to fit in for worship. Like, I don't know how a man of fife could have a wife and whoo-doo-doo-doo all day long. I don't know. But even if you have a fife, like, I don't know how that's going to play there. But man, some of you got artistic abilities. Look around. Do we need artistic abilities? These are bare prison walls in here. Yes. All right? Some of you've got some real talents to gather things together and get people together and you can orchestrate. Do we need that? Yes. Some of you are friendly. Do we need friendly people in church? That's a self-explanatory answer. All right? Some of you are really quiet and you're shy. And that, you know what? There's a place for introverts, right? Like, I think one of the things that the church has done real damage in is that everybody who's an extrovert gets to have a microphone and all the introverts just get to listen. That's one jacked up way to go, you know? And a lot of people you see up here, if in other settings, are introverts. They're the people who are just going to shy back. Now, you got some people in the room who you know there's not a setting in their life where they're ever going to be an introvert. That's just the way that they go. But it's unified because we're better when we're together. And there's humility. If all of us know we have equal roles to play here, no one can be arrogant. And if everybody knows Christ has done the same work in all of us, that all of us were jacked, all of us were messed up, all of us missed it, then no one can say, well, I'm better than you for this reason. No, but if you really know what Jesus has done in your life, it makes you crazy humble. Because you know that without Jesus, you're not anywhere close to this. And so there's humility that runs here. And man, we're all part of the same family. We're all part of the same tribe. We're all going for the same goal. And if Christ isn't here, then none of us are here. So it keeps us unified. It keeps us humble. And so if you've been transformed, then the last blank we've got for you today is transform people, transform the world. Transform people, transform the world. The band's going to come up here and start getting ready to rip, and we're going to bring this baby to a close. All right, so transform people, transform the world. 1 John 1:1-4 says that as we've started to see these things, what 1 John 1:4 says is that stuff we've seen with our eyes, the things we've touched with our hands, the things that we've had and things we've known concerning Jesus, we make that known to the planet. And so we're going to put the summary up that our story, that what we've witnessed, we make known to you is 1 John 1:1-4. And that God's gift at work in us, that what we've received, we pass on. So one of the things that's true of your relationship with Jesus is as you receive something, you're a giver of that thing. And if you listen to Pastor Gary talk, he always says, the ministry and the work God has done in you is going to be the way that you minister. And it's always true, man. The thing, your story and what God has brought you through connects with other people who have similar parts of the story. So if you don't deal drugs, God's probably not going to say, like, allow me to give you a story so you can minister to drug dealers. No, but if Christ redeems drug dealers, then what happens, man? When he starts to go and he says, man, I know the drug game. I don't know why I'm always going back to drug use. But as that plays out, there's easy ways for that. And so your story, you don't have to be a terrible convict in order to have Christ come through for you. All you got to know is what Christ has done and then be able to share it. There's this book called The Supremacy of Christ in a Postmodern World, which is a gigantic title. It's these essay papers. Okay, how do people who love Jesus interact with the world? Here's a quote for you. This means that the relation of Christ to non-Christian religions, as well as to those personally constructed spirituality, so however someone finds themselves spiritually, is no longer a matter of theorizing from a safe distance, but rather a matter of daily encounters in neighborhoods, in schools, at work, at the gas station, and at the supermarket. And what will prove to be more momentous in the evangelical world, which is where we live as Christians, that its engagement with the other religions, I believe, will be whether it's able to distinguish what it has to offer from the emergence of these forms of spirituality. We live in a crazy spiritual world. But what this shows is that we're not just going to talk about this so all of us have the really good plan, but don't do jack. This is so that, man, when you're at a gas station, when you're in your neighborhood, when you're at school, you have ways to interact with the planet that change the world. Matthew 28, 19 and 20 says that we're sent to go bearing his full authority. And so this is a great commission where Christ says, as I've done, I give you power to do also. So what should the results be? That we destroy the works of the devil, present in your school, present in your neighborhood, present in your house. That as the devil starts to do that, separation, self-hatred, desolation, devouring, you see that and you start to say, all right, I'm going to put a foothold for Christ in that. That we bring life to dead places so that while someone's in the place of desolation, we're able to speak the life of Christ into there and revive the desert island and say, hop on the plane, we're going to go get some more. And we work for the restoration of all things to the authority of Christ. And so we're in the business of restoring all things, restoring jobs, restoring families, restoring work ethic, restoring character, restoring the way that we restore all things under the authority of Christ. If you want to stand on your feet, I'm going to share this last quote with you. And it says this: there's nothing in the modern world that's a match for the power of God, and nothing in modern culture which dismisses our understanding of the supremacy of Christ, meaning Christ is over all things. There ain't nothing you know that's going to touch the authority, the power of Jesus, and there's nothing you know that's going to cause you to be able to look at anything else and say, man, Christ can't get there. So if you want to bow your head and close your eyes, we're going to take some moments to pray together. And then these guys are going to lead us in some tunes.